This is 69, the podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. 69 has been covering the digital signage industry for more than 12 years, first online and now as a podcast. This podcast gives me the time to really talk to people about technology and issues, get past the PR and into what stuff means, and help listeners understand why they should maybe give a crap. You can listen to episodes online, get them off iTunes or Google Play, or subscribe using a podcast app. Whatever way you choose, they're free and there's a new one weekly. The 69 podcast has been gratefully sponsored and supported from the start by Jeremy Gavin and his great team at ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. ScreenFeed makes beautiful looking, totally automated content for signage and digital out-of-home networks. Check them out at screenfeed.com. One of the time-honored lines used in digital signage and digital out-of-home media is how the technology gets the right messages to the right people at the right times. That's all had to do with marketing and advertising up till now. But a nonprofit called the Federation for Internet Alerts has a mission to get crucial alerts in front of the right people at the right times and places to save lives and rescue kids. Based on years of volunteer work from top coders, pro bono support from agencies and web services, and some grants here and there, the organization is sending critical alerts across North America that warn people about imminent threats like tornadoes and more insidious threats like bad air. Almost 1.5 million alerts have been processed since the platform started, and while most of that has been for web and mobile, now the organization is talking to digital out-of-home media companies about how its alerts could be on big digital screens that are everywhere and always connected. I spoke recently with the organization's founder and volunteer CEO, Jason Beer. Jason, tell me about Federation for Internet Alerts. Where did that come from?
Good question. It came about in 2011, meaning a small startup company called Atomi out of Chicago, was doing some advertising using retargeting technology. And part of that technology takes in data and then dynamically renders information in a creative format. And so what I had noticed was, you know, that the technology was quite powerful. It could be used to disseminate messages across the internet anywhere in the world. And those messages could be very detailed and very granular. And used for advertising, it was great because it provided user-level information. It allowed consumers to get relevant messages and relevant ads that they're interested in, and worked very well. And so what we started to do was test it for the Amber Alert.
So you were at this company?
I was, yes. Oh, okay. I was at this company. I was working there, and you know, I had looked at the technology and always thought, yeah, this would be really good for public safety, and it would be a really good thing to have for something like the Amber Alert, where, you know, there were child abductions, you know, and that information could be automatically activated, and creative messaging could be done really instantaneously and sent out to people in the area so that they could be aware that there was a child that needed help. And so what really transpired in 2011 was building a way to take in the feeds that come from the Department of Justice in the United States through what you call a secondary Amber Alert partnership, which we had. And it really started with a cold call to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to see if they would be interested in trying our technology out to see if it would work for Amber Alerts. And thankfully, I got a call back, and they were, you know, really hopeful that this technology would work. And, you know, at the time, there was a few hundred Amber Alerts issued every year. Many of them were, you know, stranger abductions, which are the most serious. And so we took this as a project, a volunteer effort, and a team of, you know, 10 people, you know, built in over about 3 months, a way to ingest the feed from the Department of Justice, and then disseminate those alerts through our system by automatically creating alerts and distributing those alerts across browsers in real time. And in 2012, you know, I can tell you a story about an interesting story. And in April of 2011, we had our first Amber Alert that we tested. It came out of Florida. And I got a call from the Amber Alert coordinator when we did it. And he said, you know, our 911 system that operates the Amber Alert just went down, and you're the only thing that's new. Do you know what that, you know, what might be causing it? And it turned out, and by the way, the child was recovered safely. But it turned out that the reason was is because we were distributing so many millions of Amber Alerts to the public in Florida that we brought down their server.
Wow.
We overloaded it. And we realized kind of right there, we took a deep breath and said, you know, this is pretty powerful. They had never seen anything that could do that, did that. And neither did we. And, you know, we realized right there that we have something pretty amazing. And so what we did was we fully automated it. And then in May of 2012, about a year later, we were watching the news and we saw a young child, Angel Babcock, passed away from a tornado. The Angel's entire family died, and she was found alive and didn't survive. And we thought, you know, we got to figure out a way to get the tornado warnings mm-hmm. to work. And because we wanted to expand the types of alerts that we could do using this technology. And so what we did was we worked with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to receive CAP alerts, which is, we weren't aware at the time, but Common Alerting Protocol is a standard that has been developed through OASIS, which is a standards body in the World Meteorological Organization, which mm-hmm. is a part of the United Nations. And working with them, we were able to ingest the tornado warning feed, which is a standard XML feed, and we were able to turn that raw data into a very creative alert, that flash tornado warning, and we were able to distribute those very quickly within milliseconds to people that were on the internet and near a tornado. And our click-through rates were, you know, 10 times what the national average is, because people were looking at these obviously and very curious mm-hmm. about why they were receiving them. And so, you know, we really found that this method of alerting was working remarkably well, and it worked. There's no human intervention. You know, if a tornado would come at, you know, 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night when no one was in the office, these things would go out. And they would start and stop based on what the alerting authority needed. And so they were very effective, very efficient, and worked very well. And so after we launched the tornado warnings in June of 2012, we started to look into what the World Meteorological Organization was doing with Common Alerting Protocol. And I spoke in Sri Lanka to people in about 100 different countries that were all there. They had designated people that volunteered to go to these workshops to develop Common Alerting Protocol. And they had one in Geneva, one in Sri Lanka, and then they had one in Rome. And I went to the one in Rome and spoke there to these, you know, these really great people who put public safety as a top priority in their countries. Mm-hmm. And what I found was, you know, that really they saw this technology as one of the primary reasons that CAP exists, because it really provides a way to standardize very granular data, very important information that can be transmitted what used to be typically through a fax machine at the World Meteorological Organization. They used to post paper faxes on the walls in the halls of the WMO, and people have to go look at the paper. That's, you know, in the 1960s, after John Kennedy wanted to, you know, at a UN speech, called on the world to work together on weather issues, which, you know, are really, nobody wants anybody to get hurt in a weather event. And it's sort of the great equalizer as far as missions that the WMO and the UN tackle head on to get as partners to all the countries. And what we found was that this Common Alerting Protocol was really taking us into the digital age, and the cloud and ad tech, which is what Federation for Internet Alerts uses to issue alerts, is the future. So it was like we were meeting at a perfect moment. It was timing is everything, as they say. And what I realized was those people saw this as a use case for Common Alerting Protocol in a global level. And I left with probably a much better education than I gave them, which is, you know, through my just what we do. But I also learned that what we have is very unique and special. Mm-hmm. And And that really prompted us to start this nonprofit organization called the Federation for Internet Alerts. And we did that in July of 2013, because what I found was a lot of companies in the ad tech space have a lot of very good people, have real good, you know, they have really good stories to tell, personal stories about their lives and how they wanted to help and contribute and do something unique and different. And this was certainly one of those missions. And companies wanted to contribute impressions, meaning they wanted to share the ability to allocate inventory for Amber Alerts and other hazards. They also wanted to build more robust platforms. We had, you know, coming from the startup, we built a very, very robust platform for dissemination of advertising. There was also exchanges. One in particular, AppNexus, wanted to build a hub in an exchange environment, which is a little bit different perspective, meaning that they see all the traffic globally that comes in from the internet. So we're able to ingest traffic from anywhere in the world and then decide whether that alert would fit that geographic area and then serve an emergency into that device. So the internet really knows no boundaries. And so what we, you know, the traditional borders of countries kind of drops away, and you see really the world as an opportunity to distribute emergency life critical messages across anywhere in the world where somebody could be in danger. And so these partnerships started evolving in interest. The nonprofit seemed like the logical next step, and I think it was. We recently, about 3 years ago, finished an alert hub in 2015 in July. Basically, that alert hub ingests global common alerting protocol through Amazon Web Services, and they donated grants to fund this project. And that alert hub is our way of creating a central repository of alerts.
Okay.
And it allows us to within minutes, seconds, pull in that data around the world. It could be an earthquake, it could be a tsunami, it could be a child abduction, whatever it might be. We're able to ingest that information and then process it. And when we process that information, we're able to then send that out to subscribers. And we have a number of subscribers, and the biggest of which is our subscription with our partner, AppNexus. And AppNexus really takes that raw data and then translates that into a message, a creative message in various formats, various sizes. It could be for a Samsung smartphone. It could be for a Pixel. It could be for a tablet. It could be for a desktop computer, or it could be for a digital out-of-home billboard. And what we wanted to do, based on working with the alerting authorities, we wanted to make sure that the message that was created looked the same across devices. They have that continuity of message. So we made sure to build those messages out to look and feel the same and to have the right branding, so to speak, so that when a person gets those messages, maybe on their phone and sees it on a billboard, they're able to really believe in that message. There's a lot of credibility that's given to the alert, so they'll take it seriously. And through that process, we've now increased the number of alerts exponentially, anywhere from avalanches to tornadoes to hurricanes to child abductions, flooding, flash flooding, blizzards, severe thunderstorms, you name it. I mean, there's just maybe 30, 40 different alerts that we send out round the clock. We have typically 4, 5, 6, you know, could be more, emergencies that are running, wildfires in Napa Valley. It could be any type of alert that could be life-threatening. We can get that out. So it became very apparent as we were distributing these across browsers that out of home would be a good logical next step for us.
Right.
A place for FIA to go and see if the same type of alerts can be distributed in the same type of manner across, you know, digital out of home.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed. Now, I'm not put off by the fact that you're not listening to this podcast to hear me. Just like audiences to any digital signage, you give your attention to content you find interesting or helpful. That's where my company ScreenFeed comes in. Our sole mission is to make your digital signage network more valuable by making content that is more valuable to your audience. If you'd like to drive more attention to your screens, visit screenfeed.com to explore the 75 plus content options we've created to do just that. And then give us a call. Now, back to the podcast.
Yeah, so we met at Digital Signage Expo at the Digital at Home Summit, the pre-show conference. And I gather you were there to network, and you did have a speaking slot to make organizations aware that you were out there and interested in working with these companies. What kind of a response did you get? And are there particular challenges in working with Digital at Home in terms of how scheduling works and everything else? Or is it, you know, just another notification screen?
Yeah, I had a great response as a result of giving our mission, explaining our mission to the people that were at the DSE. There were a number of companies, Verizon and Cisco and a lot of other really great brands, that the BroadSign and others that you know are very interested in integrating with us and getting alerts up on their screens. What I can say is there's a lot of good people in the industry that care a lot about protecting the public. They care a lot about using their abilities to reach a lot of people very quickly, and they understand that and want to do good with it, which is really the biggest hurdle, right? Mm-hmm. But I found that the companies, for the most part, very eager to move forward with pilot testing. And that's really where we're at right now. We're finding out the answers to your question of whether how hard this is going to be.
Okay.
I don't think it's, you know, look, we've been through some testing with some companies that are a part of the Digital Signage Federation, some of the board members. And for the most part, I believe that the ability to issue alerts should be fairly easily. What we see is a lot of the software that exists has the ability to load channels, you know, and to play through those channels. We developed a link. It's like a link that you can drop in one of the channels, and it'll serve a PSA, or if there is an emergency, it'll serve the emergency alert when it's looped back.
Right.
So that's one very easy way to do it, is to, you know, put that in and at place and then have it run continuously. As the channel is going to play, it checks, our systems check to see if there is an Amber Alert or another emergency in the area. And if there was, it would serve that. Mm-hmm. It's very easy for us to create custom sizes for digital out of home. We can create billboard sizes down to, you know, a 50, you know, inch screen, depending on, you know, what's needed. We can customize that creative and have that size screen supported.
Right. I was going to say, yeah, it would be responsive more than anything else.
Yeah. So there is the responsive angle to this, but then there's also a way we're working with a few of the partners to develop ways to check. So be very proactive and check with us to see if there's an alert, and to ping our systems to check that. And if there is an emergency, then we would go ahead and serve that. It would call us to serve that alert. So we're in the process right now, like I said, of piloting this out and coming up with the best frameworks that the out-of-home industry is going to be able to leverage. And then we can standardize the best frameworks and then push that out to all the members.
So I'm an out-of-home company, technical person for one of those companies. I was not at DSE for whatever reason. And I'm hearing this podcast and I was thinking, well, this is interesting. What are those sort of fundamental things that your platform, your network needs to do or have in order for this to work?
So right now, at this point, we do a lot of the heavy lifting, so to speak. We have the feed, we ingest that. We have the ability to take that feed and generate a creative message and to a size that suits whatever out-of-home screen size is going to be. So none of that needs to be necessary. There's nothing to worry about there. And then the company the out-of-home companies is going to use this system would want to have a browser-based display, meaning the software that they're using needs to be internet connected, and it needs to be through a Chrome-based browser or something that can be easily adapted for connecting to the internet and being able to pull in a tag or pull in a link that's going to be able to be activated through through the Federation for Internet Alerts. Those are the main core principles. And the software can be, you know, we can be flexible on how that integration actually takes place. But those are the fundamental, you know, things that you need: an internet connection and a browser based, you know, signage software.
Right. Is there any kind of a balance that you have to strike? What I mean by that is, you have, in the context of digital out-of-home companies, they have clients, advertising clients, who book a certain amount of inventory and are paying for a certain amount of impressions over a day, week, month. And if you have an alert that goes out, is there a requirement that it dominates the rotation of content? Basically, that's the only thing you see on the screen for a set period of time? Or, you know, I'm just curious if you have these sorts of discussions where you have clients who are saying, that media networks are saying, we'd love to work with you, but we have to strike this balance so that we're still able to deliver on our commitments to our advertisers.
Right now, we've been working with companies who want to designate a channel for PSA. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain percentage of public service announcements that a lot of companies will allocate to their systems. And we obviously are a volunteer organization. We don't charge for the service. Yep. And we leave it largely up to the companies that are going to run the alerts to determine what's best for them. We, you know, FEA is not a policy organization. We're a technology-driven nonprofit organization, and we rely on organizations like the Digital Signage Federation and OAAA to work through those issues with their members. But I do know from talking to them that there is a certain percentage of time that is allocated to PSAs. And considering the nature of life critical alerts, we don't see those quite often. And it's not something that I have found that companies are too concerned about, because they don't take that much time up. You know, and when they do take time up, it's usually for a very important reason, and the public needs to get information over what you would, you know, over an advertisement. So there hasn't been too much concern.
Right.
I think the concern does arise, though, when you have a mass communication tool like digital out-of-home and there's a serious emergency. Could be, you know, some kind of weather event or that causes, you know, the public to react a certain way. That there just needs to be a good, secure system in place that makes sure that these alerts aren't being issued by mistake or they're sent to the wrong, you know, areas. And we've been very careful in how we design the system so that, you know, it's encrypted, information is encrypted, it's on a secure, it's coming through in a secure manner, and the information is going out to the right audiences.
Yeah, because weird stuff happens. I can remember being in New Orleans about two and a half years ago. And, you know, it was morning and my wife and I were getting set to head out for, you know, day of sightseeing and everything. And my SMS goes off on my smartphone and there's a notification from the National Weather Service saying there's a tsunami warning for New Orleans. And I'm looking at this thing like, what the hell is this? And I'm thinking to myself, do I need to be, you know, heading for high ground, which doesn't really exist in New Orleans? But I flipped on the TV and nothing. And I guess it was just some weird data flag that sent it out. And there was no follow-up saying, oops, it just kind of sat there.
Huh.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Yeah.
I'm still here.
Yeah.
New Orleans is still there. Yeah. So. All is good.
That is very interesting. I know there was an incident in Hawaii as well.
Where, yeah.
You know, there was a missile.
A little more serious.
Missiles coming. Yeah. And, you know, with FEA, we don't have intermediaries. So I think in that case, there was somebody that was tasked with running tests.
Yeah.
We don't have that sort of scenario. No one is in between an alerting authority and FEA's system. So what comes from an alerting authority is is the real deal. We don't have somebody in between that's making decisions, which does get rid of that potential step, which could generate problems.
So do you have a timeline for when do you think you'll start to be able to see FIA notifications popping up on, you know, digital billboards and other types of digital out-of-home screens?
We are very hopeful that, you know, if not weeks, maybe a month, we'll have, you know, the first round of one or two test pilots up and running. And I will certainly follow up with you when I have some news, because I think it's an important catalyst that for us is getting the first few wins out the door and being able to show others in the industry that this technology is compatible with out-of-home software and that we can actually do this. I'm very confident that from talking to people and seeing the technology and working with, you know, with some initial partners, that this is a very very doable.
Right. Is there any reason why you wouldn't also work with, let's say, very large campus networks or even corporate campus kinds of networks that don't really have a network advertising model or anything like that, but they have a lot of locations, they're data targeted and everything else, and have a lot of eyeballs that could, you know, in the same way that a digital billboard could warn people in Tulsa about an approaching tornado, the same thing could happen on a campus through the digital signs.
Absolutely. There's really no limit to the basic technology that's used here in providing through an internet connection a creative format that matches the display size and relates based on the IP address, that we can collect the IP address. We know it's in an area where there an alert has been issued by the alerting authority. We can see that from the alert itself. Mm-hmm. We have matching tables that we can match against FIP6. So we use zip codes and postal codes in Canada, for example, and we can create messages to go on any of those screens as long as we have the basics, which is an internet connection and a browser-based software. We can do it. So this is really a fundamental change in the way people, you know, can interact with digital out of home and be provided very granular information that can save lives. And I have no doubt that, you know, as we start to get these success stories, there'll be many, many very useful cases where we can apply this core technology and help the public in a number of ways.
You mentioned earlier, made a passing reference to grants. This thing has been going for a few years now. You work for a company called Conversant, right?
Actually, I work for a company called Engine. I formerly did work.
Okay. Sorry.
Yep, that's okay. Conversant is a really great company. I spent 8 years there, and we developed the technology there. And then I moved on just for personal reasons to go to Engine, which is now also a member of FIA. So I some of the benefits of moving on was I got to bring in another company with different perspectives, and it was. It's been good, and, you know, widening the net is always a good thing.
So how has this thing largely been built out? You know, like, is it all donations of time, or have you been able to tap into grants?
We have gotten some grants but mainly technology grants. So we have companies that donate a number of impressions or allocate money for the purchasing of impressions for emergency alerts. Now, that doesn't keep the lights on, but it gives us the ability to have a cloud alert hub in the cloud, like, you know, Amazon provides us with, where it's in 32 data centers globally. It's the biggest alert hub in the world, and it captures information in a very secure way and gets it to subscribers in a very safe way. So, and so, you know, those kinds of contributions and grants are really the core of what we need. We do need to keep some funds in the till, so to speak, but it's relatively small. Usually companies donate around $5,000 a year and as a donation to our 501c3. And that's been very helpful in us getting out and educating the public and taking trips to DSC and other events and winning awards. We won 2 Webby Awards, 2 Shorty Awards for social good and having best technology categories for the last 2 years. So we've been able to get recognition for our work, which I think is important, especially for the volunteers. But all of our engineers that contribute time are doing it on a volunteer basis. And some of these engineers, I'm telling you, they're the smartest in the world. They have, what I found is that the engineers that are the best have the biggest hearts. They really do. They come and say they really want to do something good with their skills, that they're sitting behind a desk working at a bank. You know, it's great, but you know, they're getting their paycheck and they know they're doing good for the company, but they also want to get out there and they want to do something good and save lives. And this has been remarkably well, you know, a remarkably good thing for them to, you know, use their skills for good. So that, you know, that's the extent of our grants. We are always looking for ways to raise more funds because the more funds we have, the more ability we have to then develop maybe some new technology and add on to our platform and, you know, get better services.
And what does Engine do? I always look at companies like this and I can't quite wrap my head around it, but I know they're important.
They are. You know, I can give you an example of
big
how
question,
important.
Long answer.
Yeah, I'd say Engine has a technology platform. Engine is a marketing technology driven marketing services company, and we have a platform where, you know, we can provide marketing services. We can also provide digital advertising services, and we can execute on those services using our platform and our pipelines to buy and sell media on behalf of our clients. And we also run an exchange, which allows us to buy and sell media for publishers and help support the free internet. And one of the challenges that I've had through doing this is we served, you know, over 1.5 billion alerts since 2011. Millions upon millions of people have benefited from the warnings that we provided and been able to help save lives, been able to help their families during life critical events. And, you know, Microsoft and Google and Mozilla Firefox are 3 browsers that have always had an opt out and allowed us to serve these alerts through their browser to the public. Apple has not. And Apple has blocked over 1 billion alerts to the public. And the public doesn't know this. And Apple doesn't tell the public this. But, you know, if I ever had the frustration really lies in the fact that, you know, I see these alerts not get to the public. I also see the fact that publishers can't monetize their audiences through the Safari browser in the way that they need to support their businesses. And it's a real fundamental flaw, you know, to have a company like that blocking public safety messages. And I'm at a point now, and we're at a scale now where it's critically important as cable people cut the cord on cable and use the landline phones less that we have really a unified ability across browsers to serve messages. It's really that basic. And so, that's what Engine does. And so I think the alerting piece and also the advertising piece really play an important role in funding the internet and providing relevancy to consumers around the world.
Okay. So if I'm listening to this, and I'm sure Tim Cook is listening to this and feeling very badly now, how does one get involved? Do they just go to internetalerts.org?
Yes, you can go to internetalerts.org, and there is a place where you can submit your information, and we will respond very quickly. So if you have an interest in providing any resources, whether it be grants or technology specifically or engineering help, if you're a technologist, a software engineer, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email me directly. I don't know how many emails I'll get as a result of your podcast, but my email
thousands.
Is Jason. JasonB@internetalerts.org. So I'll put it out there publicly and love to hear from anybody who is interested in contributing to this cause.
All right. Thank you.
My pleasure.
That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening and learned something. If you want to stay on top of what's happening and actually matters in digital signage, join thousands of readers who visit 16.9, that's 16-9.net, every day. If you like this podcast, please also check out the companion 69 podcast called Projects. That's done by Michael Tutton, and there's a new episode every second Friday. 69 the blog and now the podcast are properties of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare bedroom in my house near Toronto. Thanks to our podcast sponsor, ScreenFeed, and thank you for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.